This is HPR episode 2431 entitled Information Underground, Local Control, and is part of the series Information Underground. It is hosted by Lost in Bronx and is about 41 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is Deep Geek, Klaatu, and Lost in Bronx chatter on about local participation and responsibility.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Information Underground. I am Lost in Bronx, and with me we have Klaatu.
Hello, everybody.
And Deep Geek.
Hey, hello, everyone.
Today, I want to talk about a particular subject that has been on my mind lately. And essentially, I'm calling this one local control. And it's about local government. I have a little speech prepared so I get everything out in a more coherent fashion because I tend to ramble. And I'll just race through this and then we'll start chatting about it.
Sounds good to me.
Recently, I took a class offered by the Sholo, Arizona Police Department entitled Citizens Academy. The class met every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. and went until 10 p.m. The class ran from the end of June to the beginning of September. All told, it was 11 weeks, totaling 44 classroom hours. This class was free of charge and open to all members of the public. This year, Citizens Academy averaged nearly 40 students. The SLPD has been offering the class to the public every summer since the mid-1990s, which I'd say qualifies as a serious long-term commitment to educating the community about what they do. And that's exactly what Citizens Academy is all about. What does your local police department, and indeed local justice system, do on a regular basis? Why do they do what they do? What are their challenges and goals? Where do they succeed and where do they fail? Many of these questions were answered in that class, at least to some degree. The Sholo Police Department is, and has been for a long time, devoted to the idea of including the general public into their process. For example, they have sponsored and supported a program called Senior Patrol. Now, many police departments across the USA have similar programs, but in short, it's an auxiliary unit of usually retired people who drive around town in specially marked cars, watching neighborhoods, calling in reports, and even acting as emergency responders on occasion. They receive specialized training in police procedures, can competently use the radios and other equipment, and are, in all ways, seen by the SLPD as valuable adjuncts to the department. They are not a joke, nor some sort of activity to keep senior citizens occupied. The SLPD credits Senior Patrol with a massive reduction in burglary and other related crimes in the city of Sholo and treats this team accordingly. Now, what makes all this work? How is the SLPD been able to garner such support with the general public that it serves when so many other police departments across the country and indeed the world have failed to do so? Occasionally with tragic results. Part of the answer may be the endemic culture of this area. Sholo is in Navajo County, Arizona, USA. It is hundreds of miles from the Mexican border, so we don't have those particular pressures to deal with. But this was, and to some degree still is, the Old West. Law and order are not just words here. There is a romanticism with the old pioneer spirit, and I would say naturally so, just considering their history. Ending with that explanation, though, is myopic, and it's begging for generalizations, misunderstandings, and stereotyping. The SLPD is an active part of the larger law enforcement environment of Arizona and the country itself, yet its root power lies in local control. The officers live here. They know the environment, they know local customs, and the area's various cultural pressures. They receive funding and support from the local city and county governments and actively seek ways to share control and shape policy with them. The class began with a history lesson of the local police departments, so we would have some context. But the next class was not about the police. It was about the United States Constitution. How do they function under that? How is their power to investigate, arrest, or use force codified or supported under the Constitution? These are not idle questions, and the SLPD policies are constructed with them in mind. Myself, I see all of this as a positive example of a small but growing community that recognizes that its power stems from its citizens, and that power is something to be used only on their behalf. Small town, small government, small law enforcement department. A community successfully policing itself without undue pressures from outside or above, that is to say, the state or federal governments. Is it perfect? No, of course not. They're chronically underfunded and often take handouts in the form of state or federal grants. That lack of outside pressure could very easily change someday. By and large, though, macro control by large outside bureaucracies is looked at with suspicion by the locals here. In an age when the federal government is looked to for the solution to many problems close at hand, including social problems like drug abuse, discrimination, and lack of opportunity, I find this sort of approach to be quite refreshing. And that is my little speech.
I think local everything is super important. I've come around to thinking about, yeah, like the need for, you know, for instance, law and order and stuff, and just how poorly that suffers, or how greatly that suffers in something so huge like the United States of America, where there are these laws being created and enforced by people who don't even live within spitting distance. I mean, they're just so far away. And the mind boggles. Like, how can they possibly understand the needs of this local community way over there on the East Coast or whatever? So I think the fact that you guys have a local program that's being so active in educating the public is amazing, like astonishing.
Well, what I think is astonishing is the use of the retired community as an auxiliary, because it just makes so much sense. I mean, first of all, a lot of people still have many good years in front of them when they retire, and doing something for the community would really mesh well for them. And they have found a way to mobilize people in a way that's useful to the whole city. I'm just very impressed with it.
That part of it is not just something that Sholo does. But back when I lived in Connecticut a long time ago, back in the early 90s was the last time I lived there, the local police department had a senior patrol as well at that time. Yet that police department, the Waterbury Police Department, Waterbury, Connecticut, at that time, I haven't been there in a long time, things may have changed radically, but at that time, they did not enjoy a lot of support from the general public. And there was a great deal of suspicion of the local police department and the local government in general. There'd been a lot of corruption, there'd been a lot of scandal, there had been budget problems, there'd been all sorts of little things. Well, not so little, really, but things that had chipped away at people's confidence in the local government to the point where the state had to step in, and to a degree, federal funding and the rest comes in. And now you got the federal government coming in with federal oversight. I mean, one of the mayors of Waterbury, Connecticut ended up getting two of them ended up getting arrested on federal charges. One was federal charges. One was on child molestation, of all things. Really, really terrible situation. And the police suffered under that. The police had a very poor reputation in the community. It's like night and day, that place, that time, compared to this place and this time. You know, this community is small. It's even smaller than Waterbury. But this community is very supportive of its, not just its law enforcement, though, also local government in general. We had one of the speakers during this class, one of the speakers was a district attorney, a prosecuting attorney, who came in. He was late to the class because he's in the middle of a murder trial that he was pushing, and he couldn't talk about it at the time. But coming in from that time, I mean, this guy probably got into work at 6 o'clock to get ready for the trial, worked all day, and then came to teach this class at night. That's a dedication to the community. You know, I'm not saying per se that this, I'm not really talking about this class, though. And I really want to get that across, that what I'm really talking about is a small community that's looking out for itself. And if there's a problem in the community, there is redress in the community, or at least the very beginnings of it in the community. I think that is the greatest strength of any society. I think it begins right here at the, not, we talk grassroots, that term gets thrown around to the point where it's almost meaningless, but at the local level, right where people live, their neighborhoods, their homes, their communities, their law enforcement departments, these people are beholden to the community. And if the community doesn't hold them to that, that's where you start having problems. You start having tragedies based on these things. At least that's my opinion.
Yeah, well, I think that's the key right there, is that in order to have some semblance of what we all call freedom, there has to be participation. And you see that in all kinds of communities, like no matter what you're involved in. I mean, you see it in open source software, because if you want, you know, open things, then you have to in some way engage with that project, or otherwise sort of the fact that it's open becomes meaningless, because you're not taking advantage of that openness. Even here on Hacker Public Radio, like way back in the days of episode like 60 and 70, you know, what are we up to now? 2,200 something. But way back then in the episodes of 60 and 70, 80, like if someone didn't throw in an episode, Enigma would email me and say, hey, we need an episode by tomorrow, you know, and I would record something. And so I kind of started feeling like it was like, hey, guys, if you don't contribute, then you're going to get another Klaatu episode. You know, I mean, that it was like this kind of sort of blackmail, like you want to hear this voice again, or do you want to send in an episode? And it just goes the same way with local society. Like if you don't contribute to the way that your society works, then it all becomes almost oppressive just inherently, because you have no say in it, because you have opted not to have a say in how life happens.
I find the same thing applies in my labor union, because I'm forever people saying, oh, the union does nothing, blah, 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 blah. And I happen to be in one of the better ones, I believe. And I actually go to quarterly meetings where the executive board just reports what they've been doing, who they've been seeing, and do the financial reports. And so I immerse myself in what's going on. And I drive, you know, across to another state to do that.
Wow.
I'm the only guy from New York there often, except for the business reps who have to be there. And, you know, it's a funny thing. I mean, I was actually, people don't understand. First of all, they're working for their membership. So they report what they're doing to their membership. The president, we don't work for the president. The president works for us. And I went and found out that my old meat wrapper was actually involved with a lawsuit with her current employer at the time. You know, because they reported that she appeared looking for help from them. And I was like, texting her in the diner afterwards, because you're driving out of New Jersey, you stop for diner food and cheap gasoline. And she was like, how'd you know? I said, I go to the meetings.
See, I find the labor union thing especially interesting, because my stepdad was a Teamster and he was a union steward in his shop. And very often he would get these dictates coming down from the Teamsters that he had either no input in or didn't really even care about, because it was just more crap coming from another bureaucracy, another layer of bureaucracy that was above him. And the only time anyone ever cared was when there were, generally, because there were either labor problems or generally there was some kind of pay question. You know, what are we going to get a pay cut or a pay raise or whatever it happened to be? And they would go out on strike, of course, because an affiliated union or something else was having problems, and the Teamsters went out on strike as well. But it all seemed so completely opaque. You know, it did not seem participatory in any way. Now, part of that was probably because he wasn't all that active. You know, he was there doing his bit, but he didn't, you know, he was working 15, 16 hours a day. He couldn't go to these things on top of everything else. And he may not have been the best choice as a steward. I don't know. That's a long time ago. And I was not directly involved. I was watching it from the outside. But I can tell you that never felt participatory looking at it. It always looked completely opaque.
Well, yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Like, transparency becomes a null point, a moot point, if nobody's looking in. And I think that a lot of times that happens. Like, people are like, oh, we're completely accessible. We have all of our records up online. You can look. But nobody's looking. And so it becomes like this pointless exercise of, well, if anyone cares, we are actually being totally transparent here, but nobody cares. And then those, I imagine, the same people who don't actually care to participate are also probably the people, you know, among the people who complain about how things go.
They often are the people who complain about how things go. I always hear people who've worked union all their life, which means they've always had the union wage. They've always had somebody, you know, trying to stick up for them if they could, though sometimes that just can't be done. And they say, oh, the union sucks. They take $8 a week from us. You know, meanwhile, you're getting that back in spades at the end of the game if you're a full-timer. And they begin bitching and moaning about this silly little $8 a week. And you go, I just look at them and I just go, did you ever work non-union? You know, and it's just a telling question.
Speaking of software projects, free software projects, hasn't the Debian project been accused of this kind of opacity in the past? That people feel like they either can't participate or there's the old gray wall where all the gray beards aren't letting anybody in or all these other things. I'm singling out the Debian project possibly through faulty memory, and I don't mean to malign anybody who's over there or even the project itself. I actually love Debian, but I think I've heard of that before in our own community. In other words, it's happening here.
I think part of that is because it's difficult. I really do think it's very difficult. We, as people coming into some place to participate, a lot of times I think we jump the gun. We think, well, I'm here now, so listen to every word that I have to say, forgetting that there are people who have been there for 20 years before us who, yes, in the hierarchy, they do have more influence, you know? So I might have a great idea for something about Debian or Fedora or whatever, but I'm the new guy. And I think a lot of us lose perspective there. It's just like, well, you said you were an open project and I'm trying to participate and you're not letting me. It's like, well, we're not letting you because we can't be sure that you're going to be around in 10 years to live with the changes that you are proposing. So that seems discouraging now. You know, now, well, this open project has just closed the door on my face, and now I don't feel so good about it anymore. So I think there is a sort of a realism, kind of a little bit of a reality check that a lot of us have to do when we seek to contribute to something, and we feel like we're not getting all the attention that we feel we should, and it's just because, yeah, we're not the most important thing about that project yet. But in the real world, I think the more common problem is that we don't really know necessarily where to go. Like, if I want to participate in my local government, what is the entry point? And I don't feel like most communities get that out very well. It's like, hey, you should come to this mythical town hall meeting. You know, we see those on TV. I remember doing extra work. There would always be an obligatory town hall meeting that you were called, you know, to be an extra for. And the mayor would stand up and talk, and then some person with a line would say something, you know, and it was like this very sort of classical 1950s scene that I think TV still thinks actually happens in communities. But like, if you asked me where to go in Pittsburgh to actually make my feelings known when I was living there, I wouldn't have known where to go. I don't know how to do that. And I think a lot of people are just like, well, vote. That's your voice. Just vote. You know, and it's like, well, that's not really my voice. That's two different options coming my way that I'm being asked to respond to. But I want to put this forward. How do you do that? I don't think most Americans know.
Yeah, it's hard. You have to, and I think these points apply to a corporate work situation too. You have to learn the lay of the land, and you have to learn what's going on and where to show up and who the right people to talk in front of are. And that's something that just comes from experience. I mean, my town is certainly not Pittsburgh, but I mean, I actually have to drive by town hall every day, and I see the town hall meetings going on in there, and fortunately, I don't participate in those like I do with my union stuff. But I mean, here it's visible. Here you can see it.
You know, I think actually, Klaatu, you have two points, and they're both really good ones. Okay. First off, I agree that people often will jump into a new community or some sort of structure, we'll put it that way, that they want to participate in, but they tend to bring a lot of ego along with it, because the motivating factor very often for getting involved in these things is an idea they have or an enthusiasm for a particular aspect of development or something else that's going on in that structure, right? In this case, I might be talking about the police department, or I might be talking about the local government, or I might be talking about a software thing. I think there are some parallels here, because we're talking about people, right? I think there is a very strong argument to be made for mentoring in those situations, right? Someone comes in, they have something to say, they have something they really, really want to do, but as both you guys have pointed out, A, they don't know the lay of the land necessarily, so they might be talking either to the wrong people or they're talking way out of turn to the point where they're adding to the noise, not to the signal. Okay? That happens all the time. Secondly, I think that a good example in the software community is you'll have someone who comes in, they're young, and no one trusts them because they don't really know them. They don't have a track record. But they're young, they're sharp, and they have really good ideas. And you're right, they do get discouraged. There is a barrier to entry there simply because people don't know that they're going to be around. They don't know that these guys are going to continue to be an active part of this community. And I think mentoring is where that comes in. Someone comes in and says, I got this great idea. I think this is really good. And then maybe a graybeard, someone who has been there a long time, can take that person under their wing and say, look, I like your ideas. I think they're really good, but how can we future-proof this? How can we make this something that's either going to stand the test of time or can be rolled back if it's not working? How do we do this and work with these people? You know, I see that sort of participation with the quote-unquote general public or the rank-and-file people in a project very equivalent to what the Sholo Police Department has been doing, opening themselves up and saying, look, this is what we do. We want you to know what we do, because the more people out there who know what we do, the fewer problems we run into. They said that over and over. You know, we are doing this mostly for selfish reasons. We want the community to understand what we're doing so that they, you know, more people are out there and they understand where we're coming from and that we're not just causing problems out there because we're arrogant and we're carrying a gun. And they got that information across quickly, right off the bat, but also very thoroughly. Again, you know, we're not seeing every police officer, and they could hire an ass next week if they wanted to. You know, that does happen occasionally, although they're very, very careful about who they hire. But my point here, I guess, in that area is just you need an invitation to participation from the people in charge of these things, you know, before an open community can really be open.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on. The mentorship idea, it's almost mentorship slash gatekeeper, almost in a weird way, because there's someone there, there's a help desk, there's a triage, whatever, to bring people in to make sure, hey, don't worry, you are actually welcome here. But hey, Tiger, slow down. Let's talk about your ideas. Let's have you go home and write down your ideas in a way that people can understand and come up with some action items and all that, you know, kind of think it out and almost give the person homework. You know, and I think 8 times out of 10, that person will never come back and yet also never feel that they were snubbed. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, this is hard work. I do have to think about this. This isn't as simple as I thought it was, you know, and that kind of gets rid of not the riffraff, but just the people who are just here to unload on you. And then the other people who do come in and get their homework done. And yes, I have thought about this. I have thought about the long-term ramifications, whatever. They get in and now you know that they're serious about contributing. I think there's a lot of value there.
You know, the mentorship idea reminds me, there used to be this thing called CORE. It was Community of Retired Executives or something. And they used to advertise on TV and sit down with people who wanted to start businesses and work through the business plans with them. And, you know, I just, you know, throwing out there that, you know, it's a shame that people who are willing to be mentors in this situation aren't in a visible organization.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. In different communities, that availability to the people either in power or with the knowledge or connections of that community. That varies. Obviously, that varies from community to community. And some communities don't see any value in that whatsoever, or it's not even on their radar. While others, you know, they recognize that, you know, much more openly. I wanted to address Klaatu's second point, which I think is extremely good. And that's the knowledge of how do I participate? Where do I go to participate? You know, that stuff is often very hard to find. Citizens Academy that I participated in, I saw that on a flyer that had been tacked up, not even a flyer, it was a poster printed on regular paper that was tacked up on a community bulletin board in a bank, right? And it just caught my eye. If I had missed that, I would have walked by it without any knowledge that this thing even existed, right? And how long did I say this thing has been around? Since the 90s? This is not something that is brand new that they just didn't get the word out on. As well established as this is, it's still almost completely unknown in the community. You know, this sort of stuff needs to be announced far and wide, I'm of the opinion. When I was leaving the final class, it struck me that every single part of the local government should have a program just like it. We had one night with the prosecuting attorney. I would love to have an entire class dedicated to the judicial system, the local one, not federal, not the Supreme Court or anything like that. How do they do this in our community? You know, because if they arrest me for a crime, I'm going to be in a courtroom in this county. So it truly is my peers, the people that live right here, that are going to be judging me. You know, I want to know about that stuff. I want to know how all of that works, but there's no way to know because they don't. And it's not like this is, you know, this is secret information. It may as well be because it's impossible to find, or it's so layered under very, very dense terminology that the average person simply, it's inaccessible to the average person. I would like to know how they do local contracts to rebuild the roads. I would like to hear when they make the order to go plow the streets in the middle of winter, who's making that call? Who's picking the call up to dispatch these guys? I want to know all of that stuff because it's my local community. And yet all of that stuff seems to happen magically, you know, like the fairies did it. I have no idea how it happens. And that needs to change. If we really want to be a participatory government, if we want this community, this civilization to survive, we need to be involved in it. We have to be part of it, or it is magic. You know, very, very, very quickly, it all becomes something that just happens. It happens the way earthquakes happen, the way the rain happens. It just happens. And there's no explanation for it. It very quickly falls into this mentality that we are completely powerless, and it happens to us. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, this is the tragedy, I think, of modern technology, because I know, for instance, that Hugh Hefner died yesterday. Hugh Hefner, I don't care about at all. I couldn't care less about this person. He made a magazine that I find despicable, and he was rich, and I never needed to know that he died.
Exception to this.
Okay, but personally, I didn't need to know that he died. I wasn't looking for him. I wasn't looking for the fact that he died. And yet somehow, just by being a human being on this planet, I heard that he died. You know, so something so insignificant as that manages to make its way into my brain within the day that it happens. But something that actually affects me, like how does my road work get done when there's a landslip on the mountainside by where I live? How does that get reinforced? Like all that kind of stuff. Where do I go to talk to someone about that? I don't know. I can't even find if I'm looking for it. It's such a maze. So like, why are we using technology to, again, just propagate like the most ridiculous like pop culture or just random complaints from some person in whatever country that I don't even need to know, but stuff that actually matters to me, I cannot find when I'm looking for it.
And it's weird. I mean, how much of this has to do with people just being oblivious in some weird general way? I mean, because we've seemed to flesh out that if you don't try to participate, you're going to have these feelings of them being opaque. But yet, like I said, I drive by City Hall. I mean, theoretically, if I had just moved into this town, I could bang on the door physically and talk to somebody behind it, you know, and ask a question.
You make a good point there.
You know, yeah. So I mean, how much of this is just being oblivious, and as opposed to the normal stuff that attracts people to celebrities? I mean, as novelist William Gibson said in Idura, some people are famous just for being famous.
Well, putting aside the question of celebrity, there is still a major problem with the dissemination of what should be easily accessible information. It's not secret. It's just no one thinks to publish it. Or if they do, it's buried under noise and you cannot find it, no matter how many searches you do online. An example, in this class, we had a highway patrol officer come in and do a whole class about what they do on the major highways. And one of the highways that they patrol actually runs through the center of Sholo. When it gets into the city limits, the name of the road is the Deuce of Clubs, as opposed to Main Street. And there's a whole story behind that. But I have a problem with one particular stoplight on the Deuce of Clubs that I always have trouble with, right? And I feel that during certain parts of the day, they have a yellow light on this thing that is so short There's no way you cannot break the law if you're trying to get through this thing. I've had times when that light is green when I enter the intersection, and it's red by the time I get out. You know, by the time I make my turn, that yellow light has just vanished, right? It's too short. That's my complaint. So I said to the guy, who do I complain to about getting that changed? And he said, well, those are the guys that have the trucks, and they go out and they fix the roads, but they're also in charge of a lot of other things having to do with the highways. He said, well, that's them. And I was like, well, who do I complain? How do I make a complaint? He had no idea. This is a guy whose job depends on this stuff, and even he doesn't know. This is not secret information. We're not talking about Department of Defense stuff. This is just, how do we rectify this problem in our community, and nobody has an answer.
Yet you do have a name of where to go. You could theoretically do a white pages search, come up with something to at least bang
You're
on
right.
the secretary's door.
No but argument. You know, my point is just that someone whose job is about this doesn't even have that knowledge. Okay.
Yeah.
That's not common knowledge, and yet I pass through that thing almost every day.
And there's also the point that you're making valid point, Deep Geek, about yes, you could go to town hall, knock on the door, and see, hey, what's going on? What can I do to get involved? That's a totally valid way to get started. But I do think that in some areas you kind of have to know to look for it. Like if Lost in Bronx had sat down one day and said, gee, I really want to take a class on the local police department, that would be one thing. He didn't even know to look for it, though. So I think there is a certain level of stuff out there that would matter to us that we don't even know to look for. And yet, much, much less can we find it if we look for it. And yet there is stuff out there right now online that would teach me all kinds of nonsense that I never needed to know and never even wanted to know.
You know, I got to admit that I don't even know if there's a town newspaper anymore. I grew up in a small town called Merrick, and we actually had a publication called Merrick Life, and I don't even know if we have a local actual newspaper.
Think about that for a sec. It's not even that I don't know where this stuff is, I'll have to look in the paper. You don't even know if it's being advertised anywhere, if there's a forum for that announcement to even be made. You know, despite the fact that I went to this police department thing, A, I don't know when the next town hall meeting might be. I don't even know where the freaking town hall is in this town. It's crazy. I don't know where
it
is.
But I'll take bets that you'll find out within 48 hours.
Yeah, that's something I can find out the moment I stop recording. Okay? That's something I could find out easily. It's not hard. I could get the address and I could go there. That's not my point. Okay? The actual knowledge of this thing is not my point. The knowledge is that it is so buried under noise, you know? And when their next meeting is going to be, and actively participating in it, it's not something that comes to us automatically the way knowledge of Hugh Hefner's death does. That stuff gets blared. You have to actually work hard to avoid that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, but it's not just that. It's also buried underneath a layer of apathy that's very hard to understand. I mean, I work in the supermarket industry, and my last supermarket after I worked there for decades went under. And the last meeting before they went under, I had one other person come with me finally to a union meeting, and I was just amazed. You know,
I feel like that apathy, I think it's a chicken and egg type of scenario, because I'm not convinced that the apathy is responsible for the non-participation as much as I wonder sometimes if the way that we have successfully buried the knowledge of how you can possibly make a difference in your local community has just created such a feeling of impotence among all the people within that community. It's just like, why should I try? I mean, really, like, why should I try to contribute to this community? I have no idea how to do it. I don't have confidence that I'm going to matter. And I like to think that if we made it more obvious to people and inviting for people to be like, hey, this is your community. Let's get together and figure this stuff out. And I'm talking on the 5-block radius level. I'm talking about local communities. Figure stuff out, assemble teams. I think that would make a difference.
So like,
I could be
like
wrong.
Like within a city's ward.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because I lived in a city for a while that had like 5 wards, and that was where you started.
Yeah.
I only found that out later. But, I mean, you know.
actually am very glad that Klaatu brought that up, because there was an article that I read today that I'm going to link to in the show notes eventually. I'm going to have some show notes anyway with this. It's an article on a site called splinternews.com, and I'll have the link. And the name of the article is "Welcome to an American City Where the Government Barely Exists." And the long and short of it is that this is a small, if you want to call it, ward within the city of Detroit. And as we know, Detroit's many problems, those have been in the news quite a bit for years now. And in this small community, they have begun to rebuild it themselves without city government participation, without federal government participation. They have worked very, very hard and are, you know, still, they're a long way from being where they want to be. They put up their own streetlights when the power company came and ripped all the streetlights out. They ripped them all out because the city owed so much money. And instead of just turning them off, they took them all back because apparently there's a rental cost even associated with having the streetlight there. They came and ripped them all down, took them all down. So you had these black as midnight streets in the gutted urban environment. And that was unacceptable to people. So they started putting up their own streetlights. They're rebuilding their community centers. They're making affordable housing all themselves. And to me, that's almost a sterling example of what I'm talking about. But it's that level of participation. It isn't, I'm going to get elected and I'm going to go to Washington, right? Because I think we've all seen what that really means to the average person. It doesn't mean very much at all, at least in my experience. Okay.
Like tones of goodbye, Mr. Chips.
I just believe if you don't participate in your, you know, I hate to use the term grassroots because it's almost meaningless. But if you don't participate at the local level, then you don't really have any idea what's going on right outside your door. Forget about Washington and all the fat cats on either side of the political fence. That's really, really not at all what I'm talking about. I'm talking about what's happening in your own town, what's happening in your own street. Those are the things that really matter to you, because what happens there is going to hit you first. If the road is bad, you're going to know it the very next day when you got to leave the house. If your water is contaminated, you're going to know it the very next day. You're going to know as soon as it happens. This stuff is local. It's immediate, and it's vital that we participate in that. But that participation isn't all on us. The government, your local government, has to be transparent. They have to invite you in. Apathy plays a part of it, but as Klaatu points out, I think a good portion of that apathy comes from people feeling like they can't make a difference, that nothing that they can do is going to change anything. But when a government comes forward and says, or an aspect of the government, in the case of the police department, comes forward and says, look, this is what we do, and we want you to be a part of it. We want you to know what we're doing. We don't want it to be a secret. Come and join us. Be part of this. When that happens, I think all the changes, and that, as corny as it sounds, the dream, the American dream, that's where it begins.
You know, not just the American dream, though, but I mean, also, I don't know if you guys know anything about Cuba, but Cuba is not based on a party system. It has one party, but they have a local level that elects people up to the next office. And people rise from the local community to the community that governs the whole island. So I don't think it's just the American dream. I think it's probably something endemic to humans in general.
Well, that may be true, but of course I'm talking from a very particular point of view, as my opening speech illustrates, that I'm coming from small town America. And a lot of the things that we see happening in the federal government that we all of us see as a major problem, bureaucracy, complete indifference to the suffering of people on a local level or across seas, I think a lot of these problems stem from the fact that we feel we cannot make a change. I mean, we had an election for a president that was highly, highly politicized and very charged on both sides, and many people feel that they went out, they participated by voting, and nothing changed. They didn't get the outcome they wanted, and they feel like things got worse. Many people feel that way. And I'm of the opinion that who cares what the federal government is going to do, right? That's Mount Olympus, okay? That's what the gods are about. Because There's no way the average person is going to make a difference there. I don't care what your vote is. There's no way that's going to happen. What can happen happens here. So what they're choosing to do in Washington, we have a say in here, because if they make a choice that we don't like here, at least the way the United States is structured, we have a say in whether or not we want to implement that. And we might be powerless, but we can do something about it. We can have a say locally in a lot of these things, but only if we participate.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.